finest American theology, by the way, has developed this, and this is his overarching theme in his theology, and that's Niebuhr, Reinhold Niebuhr, who was at Union, now dead. And that was the whole theme of his. That when you're at your best, you're your worst. That's the theme of his theology. So when we're at our best, we're the worst. Incidentally, I found in the youth movement, it was really fun to allow the kids to hassle over two questions. One, they didn't take them long. Was it easier for a gal or a guy to be a Christian? Well, that takes about 5 minutes for a group of kids to hammer out and see it. It's a lot easier for a guy than a gal, obviously. You know, a gal can be religious, but who wants a Christian girl? You know, and they all know it, and they get this pretty quick. Then the next one, they really had time hassling with. And that's, is it easier, I mean, you were along with us back in those days, you know? Is it easier to witness when you're most aware of your sinfulness or when you're least aware? Now, we'd had an awful thing going in our church. I was brought up under a youth movement that was being continually told, they'll respect you because you're different. They'll look up to you because you're different. Way up, you know. So this kind of awful thing had been sort of in the background. This was harder for them to reason through. And sometimes it'd take an hour or two while they'd be hammering this around. But they'd finally get to it. I wouldn't help them. They'd find out. We had occasion down to Estherville, the same place where I told an incident from earlier this week, where a woman fainted and didn't know where she was when she came to or anything. And it just happened to be one of the great pastors down there, was President Gordy Smithson, said she's had a pastor who she's never heard the gospel in her whole life. All he preaches is moralism. They've been told what great people you are and their speakers are different. You don't dance, you don't drink, you don't smoke, you don't go with boys that do, you know. And this had been the whole thing. And suddenly all of it shot down. And she just collapsed. Well, in the Russian literature, this is just not there at all. It's sin and grace literature, right straight through. In all of them, this is a strong kind of a running thing, particularly from Dostoevsky, from Pasternak, and from Solzhenitsyn. One of the great themes of the village each 4th of July that I lifted and made my proclamation this 4th of July, because we couldn't get any of the big shots from America, and Paul Heen wasn't here, and Leo wasn't here, so I took it. And on my country, right and wrong, it's the only country you can love. And that's a country I do love, because it's me. No, expanded. Right and wrong. But not my country, right or wrong. That's idolatry. But that's what this kind of Gnosticism builds up, right or wrong, and we're never wrong. You see? But when you say right and wrong, we're often wrong. I mean, you got to love us for the wrong, too, because that's the way we come, and that's the only we can. Like my number one girl in my family, the oldest, Marn, she's a little girl, and I asked her one time how come she's bad, and she said, well, that's how it is. Sometimes I'm good, and sometimes I'm bad. Well, you know, you got to take me whole. This is the way I come. And that's the way they come in these novels. Now, this is very shocking to some people who read it. When I say they're Christian novels, they'll say, but this, and absolutely. But it's always under this great compassion of God who has yet to make anyone mediocre or insignificant. And they speak about ordinary people. Now, this is the poorest of his novels simply because it's only a beginning. Now, as thick as that's only a beginning. This will be like these Europeans tend to run. This is going to be a novel of about 14 volumes like this before he gets through, and this is the preface. And so it reads slow. It's beautiful. He has descriptions that are just super sheer poetry. The fellow can write. But August 1914 is the beginning of his series on the whole before the revolution situation in Russia. The paperback Cancer Ward reads well. It's gruesome at times, but it reads well. But read it when you're feeling, you know, when your morale is fairly good yourself. Because it's not a novel that you're going to make you feel, you know, tra-la-da-da kind of thing. But you will enjoy it. It's enjoyable. And it's in paperback. This one is also not paperback, and you have the paperback. You can show them yours. So you can get them in cheap volumes. There's his on the first circle. I was going to say, by way of preface, is this thing on now, if you want it, that reading should always be done with delight. It's nice to read in bed. I enjoy it. And don't worry, like I did today, I was going to prepare this, and I went to sleep instead. That's what I needed more right then, and that's great. Lin Yutang, in writing about the Chinese people before his conversion, he's been converted since. In this book that he wrote, he was sort of, got it in our library, sort of anti-Christian in it, but upon our purposiveness and our sort of work ethic, and life is earnest, life is real, sort of thing of the American people, so you feel guilty if you take a nap. And he says, a Chinese, when he reads a book, he gets sleepy, he sleeps. And that's great. And they got a wonderful phrase. A lot of you people here have learned the Holden Village proverb, which is, Bupa Man, Jirpa John. Don't worry, go slow, just worry, stand still. It's a good one. It's the first one we learned when we're learning the language. Bupa Man, Jirpa John. It's easy to learn. Don't worry, go slow, just worry, stand still. But another one of their delightful tongue-in-cheeks one is, O Dalao, Sia Dalao, Hayo San Fun Sia Budao. Live a long life. Study all the time. Still flunked the exam. Still 30% you don't know. See? O Dalao, Sia Dalao, Hayo San Fun. Still 30% you don't know. Hayo San Fun, Sia Budao. Kind of, you know, that kind of a savoring of it. And then enjoy it as you go along, and you hit a good passage, reread it a couple times, and take a nap. The theme for our meditation library is read as slowly as you can. We've gotten it in our Western society from a man like Kierkegaard, it's beautiful on the same thing. Life is not a foot race. And he wrote purposely to be read aloud. And he wrote very beautifully, but as difficult as he could, so you'd have to hassle it out for yourself, because he didn't want to create another little Kierkegaard. The last thing you want to do is to be a model for somebody, and it's my conviction that I argue with the great of amongst the Kierkegaardians on the earth of how it comes around now. And I think pretty much to feel the same way I do. Sir, still, his president of the society disagrees violently with me. But I think he did it purposely. There's some desperately bad exegesis, and in his blast against the church of misdirection, really, and sort of aiding the enemy. But yet, I think he did it in order to show his clay feet. I've got clay feet, too. Now, don't make a hero out of me when I'm gone. No. And take your time, think it through for yourself. That's all he wanted. He wanted the truth. The truth is the truth for me, as he put it, when he first began. And that's the essence of existentialism. When they ask what existentialism is, the truth that is truth is the truth that is true for me. And that's your truth. And we'll be true to that and lead you to more. It's like he says again, all I ask for is honesty, simple human honesty. He says, pick a command, any command, make your choice. He says, it'll lead you to the cross. You know, pick anyone you want to, but just stay with it. And it'll make you where you're not really able to identify with it. Well, it's the fun of reading Kierkegaard. You get that same sort of a theme, and then you do learn to take your time. And Solzhenitsyn should be genius. This is just a couple of days long. It's Christmas. It starts out with a fellow who is wondering if he should do a good deed that is going to put his neck in the noose. And yet it's a professor whom he reveres who has done a stupid thing. And yet, like he says, it's human. When you know something, you want to share it with others who don't know it. And when he was in Paris with a delegation, he has divulged the results of some scientific investigation, rather on the harmless side, but after all, it was done by Russia, and therefore should be kept in Russia, to some Frenchmen. And he happened to be working in the State Department, and he knows it's been found out, and they're going to see the professor. He fights in his office. Should he or shouldn't he? It's Christmas Eve. Should he call it Christmas Eve? I don't know. What he doesn't know is they have voice recorders now that they're going to decode, find exactly whose voice it is. And that's what they're working on in this particular place where the Zeks, as they call the prisoners of the political regime, political prisoners, and they're working on this particular invention to decode a voice so they can tell, just like from a handwriting expert or a fingerprint expert, whose voice it is, and then get the guy. And he finally decides to go into a telephone booth, not using his own telephone, which could be bugged, but just an ordinary public telephone, or you pay to do it, and to call a professor and tell him that they know about it, and to warn him. Well, the professor's wife answers the phone, when he called the professor, it was absolutely a worthless act, because she only let him talk to him, said some screwball, and that sort of ends. And when the book ends, of course, they've nabbed him. And that's just sort of an overarching one. But it comes at the beginning and the end. Solzhenitsyn isn't worried about plot. The plot is essentially in all the books the same. And that is your fight to be human. It's your fight to become a human being. And as he's fighting over, should he or shouldn't he do this, sort of interesting. He said, how indeed could anyone condemn what Dobrumunov had promised? It showed the generosity of a talented man. Talent is always conscious of its own abundance and does not object to sharing. But Innocenti's uneasiness grew stronger and stronger. He leaned against the safe, his head drooped, and he rested there with his eyes closed. Then suddenly, as if he had been letting a last chance slip by, without phoning the garage for his car, without closing the inkwell, Innocenti went out of his office and shut the door, handed his key to the duty officer at the end of the corridor, put on his plain overcoat, and rushed down the staircase almost at a run, passing the permanent staff of the building in their gold braid and gold embroidery. And he ran out into the raw twilight, finding relief in action. His French-style shoes plunged into the dirty, wet snow. And he's the ruling class. He's the bureaucracy that runs things. He didn't have to do this. He's got it made. It's his career. It's his life, and yet he can't resist. this good deed. There is that in man that is there. He simply cannot resist it. Essential humanity, again, are what Kierkegaard called the universally human. He gets out in the lights, he realizes, you know, he feels almost observed, he wonders what to do. He was still hesitating, wondering whether he could phone without having someone outside the phone booth wrap the glass with a coin. But to hunt for a quiet, isolated booth, that would be even more obvious. Think of Livy, for this, you're honest, always being watched, you see, just to make a telephone call. He's just describing the actual situation. That's the way it is. I think maybe the one little interlude here from Principalities and Powers by E. Gordon Rupp. These fellows we're going to have at the village sometime. He's still being president of the church in, the Methodist Church now in Great Britain, so he could come. One of the dandy Luther scholars of the world that went to Luther's defense in World War II. But in his little book of BBC lectures called Principalities and Powers, in showing the demonic nature of human existence, he borrows from someone else whom he does not know, who's used an illustration of history in these last three centuries can be likened to a triangle, with its three triangles named after the French Revolution: liberty, equality, fraternity. And that in the 18th century, everything was liberty. And the more liberty we got, the less equality and fraternity we had. But then the 19th century is going to write this, and the big word becomes equality, Marx and company. Find the communist revolution at the end and into the 20th century. The more equality you got, the less you had of either fraternity or liberty. And then he says, God help us if now in the 20th century we go after fraternity. All we'll have left is Big Brother. There'll be neither liberty nor equality, just Big Brother. And that's really a pretty good theme for Souls and Eats in this literature. That's what you got, is Big Brother, the big boy on top. And that's what you have. Everybody else lives in fear. Well, here is this fear for making his talk. He decided, too, that it was stupid to be wandering around with a taxi driver as a witness. He dug into his pocket for a 15-kopeck piece, but all this didn't matter anymore. In the past few minutes, Innocenti had felt a calm descending on him. He realized clearly that he had no other choice. It might be dangerous, but if he didn't do it, then he's got some doubts. It might be dangerous, but if he didn't do it. If one is forever cautious, can one remain a human being? If one is forever cautious, can one remain a human being? That's the question. Actually, it's the reverse side of the coin over against our Lord's great question to us. How can you then believe if you seek honor one of another and seek not the honor which is from the only God? It's exactly the same question, except you put over against God. You just become an echo of each other. What do you think? Well, what do you think? You know, let's take a poll here. We've had a lot of this, even in the church's life. My dearest friends have been hating the church, and I've talked about this in terms of their particular ministry and leadership in their time. They've been so aware of the response before they have an action that you practically have to take a vote before you know what the question is. Whereas leaders should always be shot in the back. They ought to be enough ahead so that they're shot in the back. And they can't lead you walking backwards, watching how everybody is, so they get shot in the front. That's what leadership means, doesn't it? And it means you aren't quite that cautious. If one is forever cautious, can one remain a human being? So that's the finale. He makes the call. Nothing comes of it. Now Dante's idea. This first circle is taken from this great Italian setting of the Inferno. And the first circle is where those are who have been truly human, even without the knowledge of God. They get into the first circle of paradise. So that's where you get guys like Socrates and so on. You know, and here was a human act, so he's in the first circle. And that's where you get the whole question is then, what is it to be truly human? And that's what literature is about, actually. That's the fundamental question of anything that just isn't boilerplate stuff that's sold just to fill a glut of boredom. For every play, every movie that's really good and so on, it finally gets to you. And what does it mean to be truly good? And this novel, the same. Okay, that's as far as I thought I'd begin, just that, and then throw it over. Leo?
Well, I
might say that now they're celebrating a Christmas. This is interesting. I'll do one more thing, just to help you, and then I'll let it go. They're celebrating a Christmas party inside of this prison camp where they're working on this invention. and the Germans have gotten a hold of a little something, and they have a little tree. And this man who's been put in here because he came to love the Germans, and so therefore he was imprisoned, because, as he says, but he had not been able to convert Germans without becoming one of them, without coming to love them, and from the day of their defeat without pitying them. For this Reuben had been arrested.
He's a communist too.
And he's a thoroughgoing communist. He's a convinced communist all the way through, never changed. But he's put in because he came to love the Germans. Okay, that's what's interesting. He represents, in the conversation through the book, the party line. And even the feeling fundamentally Stalin can do no wrong. Even the party line. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention, this summer, Carol led a discussion on the First Circle, which especially he and I identify with, since it's one day in the life of Ivan Denisovich is one day in the Siberian prison camp. And the author, Solzhenitsyn, of course, has spent 11 years stuck in a prison camp in Siberia. So he wrote from his experience, it's one of the most moving books I've ever read. And it carries through. I feel with Solzhenitsyn, basically, where Alyosha is really the central figure, although he is here on a few pages. Alyosha is a Christian, a very insignificant figure, and but he has the secret. He's a free man, although freedom for him has nothing to do with the barricades and the awful, awful conditions, or the guns and the guards or anything like that. The secret he has is in the Gospel of Israel. So that's another one of his great books that's really a must. Now on this one.
One should say then all of them, you get just that little note. He doesn't hammer you with it at all, but in Cancer Ward, it's the former head of the Cancer Institute who's now examined the gal, who's now the head, and she has this fear that she may have cancer, and she does. But he thinks that the one thing modern man has not been able to do is to find any kind of tools to help him in confronting his own death. And this one here, where it specifically is where you have a couple of minor characters, but they're involved because the girl has become a Christian because she's been brought up in a family that had no faith at all, were liberals, who were giving refuge to the persecuted revolutionaries. But now the persecuted are the Christians. And she's been brought up to identify those who are persecuted, so the horror of her family, she's become a Christian, because they're the ones that are persecuted now. Well, there again, the first circle. Go ahead.
But the message, you know, on the Russian novel is Carol says so well, it speaks to all of us in our situation. And I'm just picking on somebody, and Carol isn't picking on somebody when he picks on Richard Nixon. But it speaks to our own family situation. You see it in the community. You see it everywhere. But I'll give you an example of it in our lifetime, which was I was reminded of in the discussion of Khodorkov, who is in the rear of the laboratory and out of sight of the chiefs, walked with heavy tread behind the wall of shelves to Popatov. Khodorkov was from Vyatka, and from its most remote area, beyond which through forests and swamps, a region vastly bigger than France stretched for hundreds of miles, the land of Gulag. He saw and understood more than many, but the necessity of always hiding his thoughts and suppressing his sense of justice had bent his body, given him an unpleasant look, etched hard lines on his lips. Finally, in the first post-war elections, he could stand it no longer, and on his ballot he wrote crude peasant curses directed against the greatest genius of geniuses. It was a time when ruined houses were not being rebuilt and fields were not being sown because of the shortage of workers. But for a whole month, several young detectives studied the handwriting of every voter in the district, and Khodorkov was arrested. And he went off to camp with a simple-hearted feeling of gladness. At least there he could speak out as he pleased. But the ordinary camps did not work that way. Informers showered denunciations on Khodorkov, and he had to shut up. Now, but we see this all around us. And a couple of weeks ago, I was with again we're on a scientific advisory team together, three other fellows and myself. Every year we meet to advise this particular group. Sam Martin is his name, and he was provost in charge of all health sciences at the University of Florida. And then he went to Harvard. He studied health delivery services as his specialty. He's one of the authorities in the world on this. He went to Harvard, and he was studying Sweden, England, and in Russia, their health delivery systems. And he's now a professor of medical economics at the University of Pennsylvania. And he was much sought after, of course, by the federal government on various scientific committees, and very important ones in the National Institutes of Health and this type of thing. Well, when he was a young professor, he took one of his degrees at Duke, and he was a young professor there. And when it came time for some honorary degrees to be granted, the president of Duke, very politically wise, thought that it would be most appropriate now that one of their graduates from their law school was now vice president when Eisenhower became president. That was Richard Nixon, because he took his law degree from Duke. Thought it would be very expedient to make him an honorary doctor from Duke. If you know faculty meetings in the university campuses, they're not very well attended unless there's some big issue. And then this was not a big issue when you get together and decide, you know, who's going to have honorary degrees. But this bothered Sam Martin, who is quite politically aware, and he sort of didn't like the way this young fellow had operated, because he followed him somewhat. And he and some of the other young Turks got together, and he says, you know, we're all getting up, and you can do this in faculty meetings. If you know some issue that's coming up, you get some of your friends, you organize, you go there, and since there aren't very many there, you can vote it in. Or vote it out. And this is what he did. He got some of his friends together. They came in there and came up for a vote on these honorary degrees. and it was sort of ordinary run-of-the-mill thing and everything. The president was sure it would go fine. And sure enough, came up for a vote and it was turned down. Which was, you know, they got to be out of line, you see? So somebody, unfortunately, went to the foe. He had a friend on the newspaper and hit the national headlines, of course, that Nixon's honorary degree was turned down. And the president said, well, this is just a small group. We'll get the whole faculty together. And like Carol said about faculty, you know, it'll blow your mind the way they come to decisions. But when you have a clause like this, even if most of them might have, you know, liked to see him have the honorary degree, when the president figured he'd get them all together and vote the way he wanted, that was the call to action, you see. Got them all together. Then the whole group turned it down. Well, that made it even worse, you see. But the interesting thing about it was, and Sam just told it to me a few weeks ago. I asked him, you know, how had he been in Washington on all these boards? Oh, he says, didn't I tell you? No. Just a few weeks after President Nixon got to be president, he says, I was removed from all boards and advisory committees within the National Institute. I'm not saying Richard did it, but somebody did.
Like Stalin said, to hold your time, to plan revenge, to carry out every detail, and then finally to see it accomplished. I know of no greater feeling. That's what he said, by the way. That isn't Solzhenitsyn.
Leo, can I ask you a question? I've been listening to you the best part of 4 days now, and I, never having known you before, things that you have said, I guess concerning your position in the academic world, your position in the scientific world, in conjunction with what Carol was saying, with Solzhenitsyn, Russian writers, whatever. Sort of relating it to the whole, even beyond Watergate, but American politics in the last, say 5 to 6 years, you being sort of close to anybody here to the seat of government on boards, advisory boards, do you in any way see a move to the right politically, the way, for instance, some of the other powers in the world have been, perhaps leading to a dictatorship or a centralized power much more than I don't know, I get terribly confused sometimes following, for instance, the Watergate thing. And I first reading the newspapers, watching television, stuff like that, things have been brought to the sort of public eye, public awareness. And it's, to me, personally as an individual, it reeks of something like 1984 in its attempt. And I'm just wondering if you have any sort of views, if you don't want to express them, I would understand why not. But I just...
I'll talk to you privately about that. Because I'd want to think about it for a while. It's a complex situation. But, you know, anytime you have power, there's corruption, isn't it?
Well, I wasn't speaking so much of corruption. It was just what the talk this afternoon, when you think of Silk Connection and you think of, for instance, practically 9/10 of the Russian intelligentsia, artists, writers, people like that, who are not 100% party line advocates, such as Solzhenitsyn, have sort of been downtrodden, individual freedoms being stifled and stuff like that. And when you were saying that your friend was on a board,
it's everywhere. You know,
well,
it's in the small towns where they burn books in North Dakota. It's everywhere. It's in homes and everything, and you see it. And one of the things with Zhivago, probably wasn't a great movie, but it's a great book. But you see it all through this, the bourgeoisie. The bureaucracy is compressing you. Remember the doctor when he's in a railroad car and he can't get out. You know, he can't open the window. It's stuck. You know, we're encased.
I think this is the trend in Anthony Burgess. This is his great theme in his novels, and they're fun to read from that point of view. The enemy is this continual state angle. Orwell, of course, you've mentioned. This is where he came to, and why he forsook the hope of a salvation by socialism, which had been his hope before, really. And a man who just lived with the bums and wrote two books on it, one from France and one from England, very good ones on it. And I think one of our great stylists, but really, just the last couple of years, he's permitted to live, he's dying of consumption. He wrote, 1984 and An Animal Farm, mm-hmm. just to put in front of a Western imagination where he saw the trend. And we took for our first novelty last year the chapter from Brothers Karamazov, which I call The Parable of the 20th Century, and it must, for everybody who wants to know what's happening. In his lifetime, he has to know that chapter, and that's The Grand Inquisitor. You know, our Lord returns to earth in the midst of a pogrom, and the Grand Inquisitor recognizes him, sticks him in a jail, and comes down to see him in the middle of the night. He says, "Well, you have to come back here and burden us again with yourself. It took us a good while to get rid of the burden you laid on us before. We can't take freedom, and you wanted to hand us freedom. But we understood that human beings couldn't take freedom. And we just took away that freedom that you tried to burden them with and gave them little bits of comfort in exchange for their freedom." And
there's a big difference.
You bet. You see, that whole thing sets it up. And the whole thing goes through. Dostoevsky there gives one of the finest exegesis of the temptation of Jesus in terms of those are the three issues in which enslaved man, the three issues with which Jesus is presented in the desert. The universally human is in that particular, he says. And that's where the scripture breaks through in its particularity to give us the universal. And it's a really great chapter. And then we compared it afterward to... Burgess is the wanting seed, which is seeing a future state that fluctuates between where homosexuality is the law and you get punished for having a child, to where heterosexuality is the law and you get punished if you aren't having it, you know, and it fluctuates back and forth. And this one woman that's the heroine, she has a child when it's homosexuality and she refuses to have him when it's heterosexuality, you know, and she retains her humanity. She's the one woman in it. He's got a good feeling for the feminine anyway. In fact, every woman, I hope, has read One Hand Clapping. If you haven't, you missed the finest fun novel for the feminist movement that you could possibly see. It's fun. One Hand Clapping. It's crazy. I don't know who's reading it around here right now, but it's... You'll love it. It's fun.
But in most situations, and the terrifying thing to me of Watergate is revealed, is that the end, which was reason to be the right thing for us, any means to get to that end is justified.
I was listening in Chicago a couple of weeks ago to Dr. Morgenthau, who was giving a lecture at the University of Chicago right after the Watergate, right left a few recent months. And he was talking Watergate and individual freedoms to the university there. And some of the things that he was saying, you know, to think that a group of people were so panic-stricken over someone like McGovern, but not so much McGovern as an individual, but McGovern as opposition to their points of view, to see what they have done to counteract this, to make sure that an opposing view had no chance of winning, when in probably, in all fact, if you look back at it in hindsight, McGovern didn't have a prayer anyway. Which may or may not be a tragedy, but the point being is that even knowing that, if they had even had one eye open, they would have known that the whole darn thing was so totally unnecessary. But and Dr. Morgenthau went on and on, citing case after case of this fear not to let the other person express their views. God forbid somebody should be able to have a choice between, you know, two opposing views, particularly if you're